We have been observing, watching, celebrating, getting a little teary-eyed over radical change on the program today, how the rapid changes in technology and American life have left layers of artifacts behind. We've been listening to some of those sound artifacts, but among those artifacts, in the face of technological and other kinds of change in the United States, maybe notions of life itself that we think of as unchanging. American life, propelled by the Industrial Revolution and the intensive melting and merging of American society over the past century or two, has reshaped our basic ideas of how we are born, how we grow up, what it means to mature, how we live, love, and die. This is the thesis of author and historian Jill Lepore's new book called The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. She joins us from a studio at Harvard University, where she is a professor of history. Welcome to the program, Jill.
Thank you.
I have to say, your book, Burning New York, or New York Burning, about the slave rebellion a very long time ago in New York, absolutely transformed my view of downtown New York. It was an amazing story, and your approach to history, and I think it's reflected in this new book, is amazing to me, and I just want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
So this, The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death, there's many places we could begin here, but let me just start with one big surprise that you presented, and that is our notion of adolescence that crops up in every movie that you see, every bit of pop culture that you experience in the United States today is in many ways an invention of post-agricultural America. How is that the case?
Well, one of the big shifts that demographers talk about in the last few centuries is what's known as the demographic transition. And we all kind of know this inherently, right, that we live longer than generations past did, that we have fewer children, that the average age of the population is rising. Those numbers are actually quite dramatic. And it starts first in the United States around 1800, the lengthening of the lifespan and the falling fertility rates. Those really transform how people lead their lives. And people have fewer children, and there's also a lot more attention to what come to be considered the stages of childhood. Adolescence as a notion really isn't invented. It kind of solidifies by the end of the 19th century. It's most closely associated with the work of a psychologist named G. Stanley Hall, although it has antecedents before that. Rousseau writes about adolescence. That's actually how the word, which is a French word, kind of comes into the English language in the 18th century. But it's a very kind of vague term. There's this notion of childhood, and then there's a notion of youth, but youth kind of goes all the way up to the age of 30. What happens is children stay at home for longer, and they marry a little bit later. And so the time between being a child and being fully an adult, that is starting your own family, stretches out too as the life course stretches out. And so people kind of want to name this thing and describe it. And then in our day, I think really it's almost kind of pathologized, right? It's as if adolescence is a disease. We need to treat it. You need to understand all the many manifestations of it.
Well, I'm experiencing it in my own household with two 13-year-olds.
But so am I. And I can say it does seem somewhat pathological on some days.
But as a mom and a historian and a great writer, I mean, do you really think that in agrarian days in the United States that kids sort of figured out about, procreation by watching animals and just sort of generally being in the natural environment, and then once you take young people, kids, out of that environment, they become filled with all sorts of passions and kind of boiling over sorts of sensibilities that need to be controlled by a lot of how-to manuals that you describe?
Well, there are obviously biological realities that remain essentially unchanged. Although one thing that's different is that the age of puberty has been lowering over time, right? So children mature sexually at a younger age than they used to. But then they marry later. So again, like that sort of stretching out of the time between becoming interested in sex and actually having it be in a sort of social, in a structural way, be an approved thing for you to be doing, that period of time has gotten longer and longer. And in some ways, I think more troublesome, for sure. But there is the big change that people talked about in the 19th century was, oh my goodness, children are growing up in cities and they're no longer sort of observing the rhythms of life. And so we need to keep secret from them. This is an opportunity for us to keep secret from them and protect children, extend this age of innocence of childhood until a much later date by withholding from children the secrets of nature. And so there's this kind of weird Victorian notion that children are fundamentally innocent of all sexual matters and that we can we can sort of appoint a day and anoint a moment at which we share with them these great adult truths. And so by the progressive era in the 19-teens and 1920s, there's this vast outpouring. I don't mean to use the word outpouring inappropriately here, but there's this vast flood of publications of books to how to teach your children about sex. They're wildly popular, but that's also the time when sex education enters the public schools in the 1920s. By the end of the 1920s, over half of American public high schools are teaching sex, which is a brand new thing.
We think of our culture today as sexually obsessed, but the stories that you tell of you know, lectures that people could go to all about masturbation and all these is really an astounding sort of picture of what it was like as the century turned from the 19th century to the 20th century. Let's talk a little bit about the images that America produced certainly in my lifetime, the image of the Earth, you know, from the moon, the image of the beginning of life in Life magazine, and how that has changed our notion of what it means to be a fetus, which has certainly changed our politics. How revolutionary is all of that?
I think when you look, say, over the last four centuries, there's very little about fundamental notions of how we are born, when life begins, when life ends, and how life ought to end, what life means, what the shape of a life is, that hasn't changed. And among the big changes is the rise of secularism. So how people think about the shape of a life, the beginning of a life and the end of a life, for many people has changed quite radically. And I don't think that we have really wrestled in any meaningful way, sort of taken stock of what those changes are, partly because we have such a future-driven cultural narrative. I mean, you were talking about this wonderful museum of endangered sounds and sort of looking to the past and what we might archive and what we might recall from the past. But we really have a kind of forward-driven cultural narrative that we have had since the 19th century. The story of progress is the story of daily life. Right? We measure, you know, what year it is by what version of the iPhone you have. Like, that kind of marks the passage of time. What version are we in now? There's always the next best machine coming along. That was a 19th century notion. The 19th century was thought of as the age of machines. And so suddenly people were always looking forward. And at a moment when life was really stretching out, and also when secularism was rising. And so what kind of the end point is of a life really changed. And the notion that life is not really essentially circular, that we kind of, when we die, we go back to where we were before we were born. When we die, our children replace us. That life just kind of turns around in a constant circle. For many people, that notion no longer obtains. And I think it causes a tremendous amount of anxiety. And it also seizes up our politics, because these are discussions that are very difficult to have across very profound cultural divides.
And yet the images of life and death are all around us. We're talking with Jill Lepore, author of The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. How unusual is it, and how new, and what are the sources of Americans' attempts to actually plan their own deaths, to think about what is an appropriate moment to end life in a very, very straightforward discussion in our political system and in our religious and moral discussions?
I think those conversations go far back in many ways, but in the 19th century, for instance, there was the notion prevalent in American life that's a much more antique notion of a good death, and the good death involves resignation, and the day of your death is, you know, in Christian doctrine, a kind of day of glory. More specific notions of planned deaths and euthanasia, those really date to the progressive era and the rise of sort of the scientific management of everything. A lot of how we think about our daily life comes from that era, how we think about efficiency, for instance, and the work of management consultants and how we think about a business being run more efficiently. That prevalent notion of efficiency also had an analog in the world of conversations about how long a life should be, when people should die. So there is that. In terms of our current day politics, I write about in the book the case of Karen Ann Quinlan in 1975, which is something that really affected me when I was a kid growing up, because the story, if you will remember, was in the news everywhere.
No, she was brain dead. It was not completely clear what the story was with her, but you know, there was a discussion over whether her life should be ended or not.
And it led to a massive political outcry. and I think a lot of our conversations about the right to die, and even going back to the death panels conversations a couple of years ago when Sarah Palin invoked this notion during the healthcare debate, come back to that case in 1975.
Amazing. Well, there's all sorts of things to read about in The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death, how extraordinary change has affected some very profound understandings of life itself. Jill Lepore, thanks so much.
Thank you.
She's a professor at Harvard University.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.